Now, first of all, this talk on meditation, you may ask, as many people do, they haven't asked me yet here in Sabah, why am I a Buddhist monk? No one in my family were Buddhist. They could not even spell the word. And it was just a matter of good fortune. I picked up a Buddhist book and started reading it and realized I was a Buddhist. But the biggest change in my life came when I did go to Cambridge University in 1969 at the age of 18. I was very pleasantly surprised to see there was a Buddhist society in Cambridge. And that was the first time I met any other Buddhist. For two or three years, I thought I was the only Buddhist in England. I didn't know where to find anyone else. And there was a very strong, dynamic Buddhist community. And I was extremely fortunate that in that community, at university, every Sunday afternoon there was a meditation session. And the person who taught that meditation session was a man working in the Thai embassy in London who had practiced meditation with one of the great monks in Thailand, Ajahn Buddhadasa. And when he started teaching meditation, I remember he said, I'm teaching you meditation for one reason, so each one of you can experience the first jhana. In 1969, there was a man teaching jhana meditation, which was extremely rare. And I was very fortunate to have such a teacher. And it was only later on, when I became a monk, did I realize how rare and how important that was. Because most of you Theravada monks, who cares Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana? For those of you who don't know, that I really share the thoughts of the president, who was saying that it's wonderful that we work together and that we try and dismantle these walls which separate our traditions. So I don't really care, Mahayana, Vajrayana, Theravada, Hinayana, if we cannot be friends, I don't know who can be friends. And in fact, in Australia, I've had the opportunity to try and bring those three traditions together. So in order to bring those three traditions together and give it a name, because sometimes people say, what tradition do you really follow, Ajahn Brahm? So I decided to combine their names. I take the H from Hinayana, the Aha from Mahayana, and the Yana from Vajrayana. And you put those together, and what does it spell? Hahayana. There you go, another Hahayana. So that's my tradition, the Hahayana. H from Hinayana, Aha from Mahayana, and Yana from Vajrayana. But from whatever tradition, you should all know basic Buddhism is that the way to enlightenment is the Eightfold Path. And that was said again and again and again. You know, such as verse 274 of our Dhammapada, Ezo wa mago nati anyo dasanasa visuddhiya. And I say that in Pali because I just want to impress you that I have done my studies. I don't just speak from my own ideas. This is, everything I say today is based on the sutras of the Buddha. So what that means, that's the Pali, it means this is the only path, there is no other for the purification of insight. Referring to the Eightfold Path. So we have the Eightfold Path is the basic teaching of Buddhism as a way to enlightenment. And as you should all know, because many of you have done your basic studies of Buddhism, the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path, number eight, Samma Samadhi, is always, every time, maybe 150, 200 times, defined by the Buddha as jhana. First, second, third, or fourth jhana. He never mentions anything else. To fulfill the Eightfold Path, it has to be jhana. and nothing else. So I was very fortunate to be taught this from the very early times and be encouraged to develop meditation to the point where you can enter and experience the amazing, wonderful jhana. And it was such experiences which made me a monk. Now, because I'm a Western monk, I can say things that maybe Chinese monks can never say. And one of the things I say is, the first time I got into a deep meditation, I was still a layman. And I had a girlfriend. And strange thing, I need to say this, I was sleeping with my girlfriend, and I remember just sleeping with her and then leaving her in Gloucester in England and going to Cambridge for a meditation retreat. And when I was on this retreat, I got a very wonderful meditation. And that was where I realized, my goodness, the bliss of meditation is better than sex. And I just know, about a week earlier, just had sex with my girlfriend, and I was in meditation, and this was much more profound, more pleasurable, more longer lasting, and also there was no chance of having babies. Now, of course, that really surprised me. Why is it that something could be so profound, so deep, so intensely pleasurable? Why didn't anybody tell me about that beforehand? And that really got me interested to see that, you know, the important things of life, the pleasures of life, is another whole area in the realm of meditation where you can get very deep, very still, very blissful, but also amazing insights. And when you started reading the teachings of the Buddha and found out, yes, now that's the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path. It's important, it's necessary if any of you want to become enlightened. So, to explain what a jhana is and explain how this meditation works, last night I gave a little simile. And it starts from understanding that meditation, it's an English speaking group here. It'd be much better if you were Chinese speaking, because sometimes in English we get the words wrong. For many, many years, we've called meditation concentration. That is a very bad translation. So for many, about 4 or 5 years now, I've been using the word stillness for the eighth factor, for samadhi. Samadhi, not concentration, but stillness. And it was only last year we had a lady, she was a professor from MIT in Boston, US. And when she heard me talking about meditation or samadhi being stillness, because she had read the Agamas, you know, the Chinese sutras, she said, of course it means stillness. Because the two Chinese characters for samadhi in the Agamas, as I mentioned last night, Xu and Guan, which I probably pronounced terribly, but Xu is the character for stillness. Guan means observing. Guan, yeah. Guan. And the first one, stillness, Xu. Guan, yeah, and stillness is Su. Su, yeah. That's stillness. Now that's how the Chinese masters translated the word samadhi maybe 1500 or 2000 years ago. And they got it right. Westerners, we got it wrong. It's not concentration, it's stillness. The more still your mind, the closer you are to these jhanas. How to get still? As I mentioned, how many of you were there last night? Please put your hand up. Okay, great, all there. So I'll just mention this very briefly. Now I held a cup up and I asked, now you, can you please tell me when it becomes still? And the more you hold it, the harder you try, the more it moves. The only way to get a cup of water still is to put it down, to let it go, and it becomes still all by itself. It's the nature of this water to be still. Only when I hold it does it shake. It's the nature of your mind to be still. Only when you grasp it does it move. So the whole trick of meditation is learning how to let things go, leave them alone, put them down, so the mind becomes more and more still. Now, the wrong way of practice, number one. That number one is holding it. Number two, you let it go, you put it down. And after maybe 1 or 2 minutes, is it still yet? No, not yet. Still yet? No, not quite yet. When are you going to become still? Come on. Please don't interfere with the process. Your job in meditation is to let go and continue letting go and just to let things happen. You are like a passenger, not on MH, not on Air Asia, not on SQ, on Buddha Air. Now, once you get on Buddha Air, all you need to do is sit down in your seat, put on your seat belt, and you don't need to do anything else. You can't go and send a message to the pilot, "Can you please hurry up? I've got to get to the destination quicker today." Or, "Can you please take shortcut? And I'm just coming into KK for the first time. Can you just do a pass around Mount Kota Kinabalu so I can see it?" No matter what you want, that pilot will pay no attention to you. So when you are traveling in an aircraft, all you do is sit down, shut up, and enjoy the journey, which is what you do when you meditate. Sit down and let go. Now I'm going to tell you one of the most profound descriptions of meditation from Ajahn Chah, from my teacher. Unfortunately, I don't know why, this has never been put in any of his books. I'm trying to put it in one of my books, so at least it's recorded. Because when I first went to become a monk with Ajahn Chah in 1974, I think it was, he would repeat this story many times. And then he'd stop talking about it. He never repeated it. But I remember the first year he kept saying that his monastery in the northeast Thailand was a mango orchard. There's no mango trees there. I wondered what he was talking about. And he said in that monastery, those mangoes were planted by the Buddha. Now I realized he was making a simile. And he said those mangoes were planted by the Buddha many hundreds of years ago. Now all those trees are mature, and in every branch there is very beautiful, delicious, sweet, ripe mangoes. Thousands of them, he said. And you monks, he told us, don't need to climb the tree to get a mango. You don't need to shake the tree, nor do you need to throw a stick up to get the mango to fall. You monks, because of the wisdom of the Buddha, all you need to do, he said, to get a mango, is to sit under the mango tree, hold out your hand, and a mango will fall. I thought that was crazy. You've seen mango trees. If you sit under a mango tree and hold out your hand, you'll be waiting there for hours, maybe days, before one falls. And if it does fall, it's more likely to fall on your head than in your hand, at least with my luck. But obviously he meant something much more profound. He said, if you want to achieve a jhana or enlightenment, you must not shake the tree. You must not climb the tree or throw things at the tree. Your job, open up your heart, your mind. Be still. and all these things will fall into your palm. And that's exactly what happens. Many, many, many times I have lay people on the retreats which I teach getting into jhanas for the first time by accident. But a good example is this girl from KL, who was teaching a retreat, I think it was in Phuket, and she was meditating and meditating, trying her best, and after 9 days, got nowhere. For those of you who've meditated, you may understand what she felt like. Really getting up early, putting lots of time meditating, but never actually getting much peace. So she gave up. But there was another hour before her taxi came to take her to the airport. Oh no, sorry, another hour before lunch. And after lunch, she was going to the airport to fly back to KL. She had an hour to kill. So she just sat down and meditated. But the first time, she wasn't expecting anything. She was just killing time. And after the meditation, she came up to me, squatting on the floor with her hands up. Hajabram, at last, I've got something in my meditation. She got her first deep meditation. It was very sweet to see. And it was also because for the first time, she really let go. She climbed on the aircraft, Buddha Air, and stopped making demands, stopped asking for things. She had let go. In the Buddha's teachings, just before the Buddha became enlightened, he went to the river Niranjara. He put his bowl in the river and made a resolution. If I am to become enlightened, may my bowl flow against the current, against the stream. And those of you who know your story of the Buddha will know that that bowl floated upstream against the current. It was a sign the Buddha was going to become the Buddha. But also, it was telling you how to become a Buddha, to go against the stream of craving. To go against the stream of craving does not mean craving to stop craving. It means going in a very different direction. I've already told you that the way to get deep meditation is to let go. So some of my stupid disciples in Australia, okay, I've got to let go. They close their eyes, come on, let go. Let go. Come on, let go. Let go. Let go. Now, of course, that's not letting go. That's trying to let go. What I mean is letting go of trying. Taking this little thing inside called your will, calming it down, so it gives no orders. It gives no commands. You are mindful, one, and still. If you can do that, you're on the path to meditation. Because what happens when things are still? They disappear. Have you ever noticed that when there's a sound of, say, the fans, now you can hear it. Maybe a minute or two ago you weren't conscious of it. Because the sound doesn't change, our mind stops hearing it. Our brain is only wired to notice things which change. If they are still, they disappear. And a good example, when you do meditate and you close your eyes, you may notice what you see at first is the inside of your eyelids. It's dark. But because that does not change, after a while, your sense of seeing turns off. It stops. You're not seeing blackness anymore. You're not seeing anything. The sense of seeing has stopped. It's just a function of the brain. If you're sitting perfectly still, if nothing is moving, your body disappears. That's what's meant to happen. So many times you're sitting there and you can't feel your legs or your bottom or your hands or anything. That's fine. That's what's supposed to happen. Because nothing is moving, it vanishes. Listen, there was a Malaysian couple living in Perth. And they told me once they were so focused on the movie they were watching at home that everything else disappeared. They were totally focused on the movie. And once the movie was finished, one of them went up to go to the toilet. The other one went up to make a cup of tea. And only when they got up, they noticed that several things were missing from their house. Even just behind them, many things had disappeared. And they soon realized a burglar had been into the house and had actually been right behind them and taking things from the shelf, right behind them. And they hadn't heard anything. You know why? Because they were totally focused on the movie. And everything else had disappeared. This is how things disappear. When the mind is focused and still on one thing, everything disappears. So the way to become still is a very well-traveled path. The first thing when we meditate is to keep in the present moment so that time disappears. Too often we are caught between the past and the future, and most of our brain moves from one to the other, so much so that time never stands still. We're always on the move. If you can find yourself in the present moment, soon the whole meaning of time vanishes. All time is a measurement between the past and the present, the past or the future, or the present and the future. It's just a measurement between two or more moments of time. In the present moment, there's no way of measuring anymore. Time stands still, and time disappears. All of you who are prisoners of time, just getting to that stage of meditation where time vanishes is a wonderful experience. You don't know whether you've meditated for 5 minutes or an hour or 5 hours. You've been perfectly alert, but no longer a prisoner of time. It's vanished. The next thing which vanishes is your thinking. We think far too much. Our mind moves. But when the mind becomes still, all that thinking vanishes. I will now show you what I mean. As I am speaking, I also want you to be aware of what's happening inside of your own mind as I speak. Because as I'm speaking, you will begin to notice that there are spaces between my words. In those gaps, what was happening inside your mind? You were aware, but not saying anything, not thinking. There it was again. That is called silent awareness. You're perfectly alert, but no inner chatter. Understand? Why don't you just experience that again? Or many of the business of your life, because it still vanishes, you feel a great sense of freedom. So then, because you're sitting still, you can't feel the legs after a while, the hands, the body or the head. You know the one thing which keeps on moving, no matter how you sit meditation, there's still one thing left which is moving. Your breath, your lungs are still moving. Which is why in meditation, even if you don't try to watch your breath will appear to you. Time has disappeared, the inner commentary has disappeared, the body has disappeared because it's still, it's not moving. The breath still moves. That is one of the reasons why the Buddha taught the breath meditation. It's natural. Whether you choose to do it or not, it just happens. So you're just sitting there watching the breath go in, watching the breath go out. Because you're not doing very much. You don't need so much oxygen. Your breath gets softer and smoother. Until, again, this happens naturally. You don't have to try and do anything until the in-breath and the out-breath appear pretty much the same. Just a smooth experience of breathing. When there's hardly any difference between the beginning, the end of an in-breath or the out-breath, when your breath gets very, very smooth, when there's no change, what do you think happens next? Your breath disappears. And with it, the last part of your five senses vanishes. Because of stillness, they disappear. Sight has turned off, hearing has turned off, smell, taste, and now the difficult body is turned off. It's one of the reasons why we try and sit in quiet places, or at least places where the sound doesn't change, so that the sense of sound can also turn off. When the five senses have turned off, only then can we experience the sixth sense, which is the mind. You may all know from your Buddhism, there are six senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and mind, or knowing. And this is what we're doing in this meditation. We're coming to that sixth sense. Any chemist, if you want to find a property of any element, you have to purify it first of all. Just like the Buddha said, if you want to find out the properties of pure gold, you have to take that gold and first of all make sure there's no other trace elements. There's only 100% pure gold, and then you can find out its properties. In the same way, if you want to know what this mind is, the citta, you have to make sure all the other elements, the other five senses have disappeared, and then you can actually understand what your mind truly is. When the five senses disappear, what usually happens is people see this beautiful light in the mind. They have a word for it in Buddhist meditation called nimitta. Beautiful, radiant, like a flashlight, like a moon, like the sun, it can get incredibly powerful. That is to be expected. I mention this to you because it happens to many meditators. When that comes up, people usually get excited or afraid. Please understand those are the two main obstacles to jhanas. Fear and excitement. The only reason is excitement is because you think this is another great attainment. Your sense of self gets in the way. And the same as fear. You're about to lose something which you're very attached to. Allow it to go. You're finding out some very deep and powerful insights into what the Buddha taught. The Buddha said that mind is radiant. He called it prabhasaracitta. And now you have it right in front of you. And it takes a lot of skill to be able to get that nimitta just to be quiet, calm, for it to become still. Your mind has to become still. Stop doing things. Really relax until that nimitta just stays there. And then you will experience one of the two possibilities of falling into that nimitta or that nimitta coming to envelop you. But at that time, you're not experiencing a nimitta or a mental image anymore. Now you're in those jhanas. And what you're experiencing is extremely strange, nothing like you've experienced before. You come out afterwards, you have got into the greatest state of bliss you've experienced for a long time, forever, for many lifetimes. You've got one of the great bliss states, ecstasies, bliss better than sex, lasting for hours. And I say that because it's marketing. People get very interested when I say that. And for those people who say, oh my goodness, I will get attached to that happiness, well done. You are supposed to get attached to that happiness. As the Buddha said in the Parsadika Sutta of the Digha Nikaya, listen, we taped, you can look it up yourself afterwards. The Buddha said, if anyone says, oh, you'll get attached to the happinesses of those jhanas, you should say to them, yes. But anyone who gets attached to the happiness of the jhanas can expect only one of four things. This is what happens if you do get attached to the happiness of jhanas. The four possibilities, only four, not five, stream winning, once returning, non-returning, or full enlightenment. That's what we're supposed to do. It's a path to enlightenment. So indulge in it. The Buddha said many other pleasures, especially for monks and nuns. There's so many things we can't enjoy. You can't enjoy movies, you can't enjoy sex, you can't enjoy food, you can't enjoy this, you can't enjoy that. You know what? That's why they call, in English, they call them nuns. None of this, none of that. But the one thing we can enjoy are the pleasures of the mind. The Buddha said, Nabhayitabhang, Bhavetabhang, Bahurikatabhang, Asewitabhang, to those pleasures. In the Aranavibhanga Sutta, for one, many other places too. Don't be afraid of those pleasures. Follow them, make much of them, develop them. And that's the Buddha's advice. So when you do get happiness in meditation, don't be scared. You're on the path. This is what's supposed to happen. Enjoy it. Now when you come out of those jhanas, that's when you get incredible insights, especially into non-self. To give you an idea what I mean, and then we'll open it up for questions. This is my last simile. Once there was a little tadpole. A little tadpole, she was swimming in the lake, but she was very smart little tadpole. So when she started hearing dry land, dry land, dry land, she wondered what they were talking about. And they said, oh, that's a place where there's no water. And she said, what's water? Because how can a tadpole know what water is when she's born in water and lived all her life in water? She even went to university and did courses on chemistry about what water is, H2O. She even went to Abhidharma classes on water. But doesn't matter, she still can't understand what water is. Because it's always been there. One day, little tadpole, something strange happens to her body. Little legs and little arms start to come out from her body. And they grow and grow and grow. Little tadpole is becoming a frog. And once she has developed her legs and arms, one day she jumps out of the lake. And that's the strangest experience she's ever had. All her life, all she's ever known is being in water. Now something which was always there, so much she never noticed it, has now vanished. It's disappeared. Now little tadpole knows, ah, that's what water was. The thing which is no longer there. That is the wonderful simile for the insights which happen from jhanas. Do you think you can really understand your body? What it is? You can learn from all the monks and nuns about the nature of this body. You can become a professor of medicine. Still you don't really understand this body, because you're always in it. You've never known anything else except being a woman, being a man. One day, you grow your little meditation legs and you jump out of the body with its five senses. Now you know what this body is. You know one of the first things you realize? This body is a pain in the neck. It really is suffering. I mean, big time suffering, much more than you can imagine. And that's one of the reasons why when you get into jhanas, it's bliss. Just like you've let go of this very, very, very heavy burden. Just like you've been carrying a backpack, a rucksack on your back all your life, as long as you can remember, so much you've got used to it. And now you put it down for the first time. Oh, this is so nice. No, wait, I'm free at last. That's what it's like to let go of the body. That's the main reason why that you have the happiness and bliss in the first jhana. It's called vivekaja sukha. The happiness, the bliss, born of viveka means separation from the five senses and this body. When you get into a second jhana, woohoo, now you're really pissing out. This bliss is even more. You think that the first jhana is the best you can possibly ever have. But this is more bliss, 1,000 times more bliss than even the first jhana. And there you really are still, like a rock. Nothing moves. You can't even come out. You're stuck, blissfully stuck, having a time of your life. You know why? There's something you call the will, the choice, the person who you think chose to come here today, the person who just scratched his forehead, the person who just scratched his nose, the woman who just scratched her hair at the back. The one who's scratching his nose right now. Did you do that? You think you did, but actually, sir, you did not. That was an automatic response. It appeared like it came from you. But what happens in the second jhana? The will has totally vanished. Now you know what that will is. You can't know a thing when it's always there. A fish can't understand water. A frog can, because it can get out of the water. You have now left will. Now you know what it is. Nothing to do with you. This is one of the scariest teachings. In Singapore many years ago, I was giving all the teachings like I gave last night. The fun teachings, such as the going into the chicken shed and collecting the chicken poo. Things about good, bad, who knows. But after a while they said, oh, we've heard those stories and jokes many times. Can you teach us some deep dhamma? So I said, okay, I'll teach you some deep dhamma on non-self. And I taught them that, and the following day they complained. That was too deep. We couldn't sleep last night. But I don't care. After the second jhana, what vanishes is the will. That's real samadhi. It's samadhija sukha. The bliss born of total stillness. Now you know this will is not your friend. It is your enemy. Number one enemy. You really come here, many of you, to learn Buddhism, thinking if you can just make your will more smart, have more skillful means, you won't need to suffer anymore. In your life, in your career, if you can actually make the right choices, then you can alleviate suffering. Once you understand what this will is, you understand that no, it's nothing to do with you. It's non-self. As the Buddha often said, there's no one inside. So who chooses? Who makes those choices inside of you? It appears that it's you. That's a delusion. Now you sometimes have to try and break through that delusion. And basically jhanas are the only way you can break through. Tadpole has to become a frog and jump out of the lake. That's the only way to know what water is. If you haven't jumped out of the lake of will, you'll never understand what will is. All of you, you know that person in Buddhism called Mara? No, Mara? Mala, yeah. You know he's the Deva. He lives in the realm, the Paranimitta Vasavati realm. He's the head of that realm. This is the realm of those who wield power over others. He is control freak, in chief of the universe. There's another control freak inside of you. It's called will, Chaitanya. Always controlling you, never giving you a moment's peace. Come on, work harder. Come on, meditate harder. Come on, be smarter. Learn more things. Exercise. Do this, do that. That is the problem, not the solution. So after a while, you see that that's not yours, nothing to do with you. It's disappeared. You aren't the one who chose to come here today. All cause and effect, you had no choice. It appeared you did. That's the delusion. Good example of that, before I said this was a lot, I should actually finish to keep my promise. So that's jhanas, that's non-self, at least half of it anyway, realizing you are not the one in charge. There is no doer. The will, you think it's under your control, but it ain't. That's enough to give you an understanding of how non-self and jhanas all come together. Just one last little quote from Visuddhimagga. The path is, but no traveler on it is seen. If you try to meditate, there is no path for you. The traveler, the meditator, has to disappear first. The path is, but no traveler on it is seen. Let go, disappear. Sit down on Buddha air, shut up. And what happens? After a few minutes, this flight attendant comes, this beautiful girl, and comes, Ajahn Brahm, would you like some, the in-flight service, not the in-flight service, so the insight service. The insight service. Would you like some jhana today? Jhana's on the menu. And I'm just sitting there, and they say, oh, first, second, third, fourth, I think I'll take third today, thank you. And they come a few minutes later and give you third jhana. You don't do anything. You don't search for it. You just sit there and wait. And third jhana comes to you. And later on in the flight, they come along and say, on the menu for lunch, we have stream-winning, once-returning, non-returning, and arahat. Which one would you like? So I had non-returning last time. Please give me arahat this time. Everything is served to you. You don't need to go pressing the call button for the attendant. You know, they get very upset when you keep pressing that call button. You just sit there and everything comes to you. That's how it works. No will. No shaking the Bodhi tree. Stand under it, open your hand, and all the fruits, the passion fruits, will fall into you. So that's jhanas and non-self. So it's easy. So easy, you don't have to do anything. That is the hardest thing for anyone to achieve. That's why few people get in line, because they keep on interfering. See if you can just let go. Okay, so now it's supposed to be done with discussion, and I've done most of the talking. So come back at me with some comments, questions, or complaints. Remember, I'm a Western monk, so you don't have to be respectful. You can ask tough questions. Yes, thank you.
Graphic, and I believe studies have been done on some monks meditating to see how their brain waves work, that sort of thing. In terms of the calmness achieved compared to, say, ordinary people that are not meditating, they try to link perhaps the pattern of the brain waves to the physiological aspect of the person, the monks, as compared to, say, some other patients that are suffering from illnesses.
Yep.
So, as far as you know, has there been any update on this sort of studies, you know, where they put those electromagnetic thing onto the brain and study them? Thanks.
Okay, you're referring to the studies done by Professor Davison, Wisconsin University, on Buddhist monks. What he was actually doing, he was getting these monks to meditate under the functional magnetic resonance scans, because there is an objective way of measuring how happy you are. That's very easy. You ask someone, are you happy? They say, yes, I'm happy, but they're faking it. They're not really happy. Anyone can say that. But if you really are happy, there's part of the brain which lights up. So he was, you know, measuring all these people to see, you know, what makes them happy. And when he came across the Buddhist monks, they went off the scale. They're not just happier, they were way happier. Because they were meditating. And this was not just, you know, how they felt subjectively, this was objective. Part of their brains were just exploding in light. But that's only the start. And now I don't want to scare you, because it's perfectly safe when you meditate. I've been teaching meditation for years and years and years. I haven't had any casualties, no one's died, no one's gone crazy. I know many people have gone crazy because they haven't meditated, but meditation is perfectly safe. So with that in mind, I'll tell this amazing story. One of my disciples over in Perth, he would only meditate maybe for half an hour, 45 minutes. One Sunday afternoon, there's nothing on the TV, so he told his wife, he's a, you know, Caucasian, Hung Mo, he told his wife, I'm just going to go in the bedroom to meditate for a short time. So his wife watched a movie or something, and after about an hour and a half, he hadn't come out of his room. So he went to check up on her, on him. And she went into the room, and he was meditating, perfectly still. Too still. She couldn't see his chest rise and fall. He wasn't breathing. So straight away she called ambulance. Within 5 minutes, the ambulance arrived with the sirens wailing. These trained medical officers rushed in, saw he wasn't breathing, checked his pulse, could find no pulse. So put him in the stretcher and raced to the hospital with the sirens wailing. Na, 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 going through all the red lights. Da, 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 da. It's an emergency. There was no sign of any heart activity. So they rushed him straight into the emergency room. And you may have seen it on the TV. All these people rushing around you, strapping this on you, strapping that on you. They put on the ECG. Now measuring any heart activity. Flat line. Ding, 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 ding. Emergency. I've been told it doesn't go ding, 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 but still I say that because it makes it more fun to actually to relate. It was a flat line. And then they put on, any doctors here? Doctors here? Okay, very good. And then the EEG as well. Another flat line. No brain activity, no heart activity. It was very, very lucky that the person on duty that afternoon had come from India as a boy. Now, with his parents had migrated to Australia, and he'd done well at school, become a doctor, and he was on duty in the emergency room. Because he was from India, he had heard that some yogis, through deep meditation, had managed to suspend all their life activity. And he knew from his wife that he'd been meditating, so he thought this may be such a case. So he put on defibrillators, these pads which pass electric shocks through you, which again, they make you jerk up from the hospital trolley. Many times, according to his wife, they tried to get his heart started through defibrillation. Nothing worked. Until he decided to come out of his meditation. He opened his eyes, he bent up, beep, beep, beep. All the monitors were normal. And he looked around, what am I doing here? I was in my bedroom. And the doctor gave him a thorough examination, could find nothing wrong with him at all. So just discharged him, and he walked back home with his wife. Perfectly healthy. Now that is what it's like to get into the real deep meditations. It's not the brain activity gets, well, it does become different, but soon you get so still that not just the heart stops, so does the brain. Perfectly still. With no damage at all to the body. He's still alive, that was many years ago. Perfectly healthy. Now that is weird. Because it was not done under laboratory conditions, it was just happened by chance, and it's not really recorded. But nevertheless, that is what happened. And I asked him, what was happening during that time? Could you feel those defibrillators? No. Could you hear those sirens? No, 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 no. No, couldn't hear anything. So were you unconscious? He says, no. The most wonderful experience of my life. So peaceful, so still, so much bliss. I was having the time of my life. So that is what it's like. So that's latest research. That's secret research. But you don't have to worry. Some people say they get scared when I say things like that. You don't need to be scared. It's great fun. Enjoy it. Take it from me. I'll give you money back guarantee. You'll survive and be a much better person. I don't mind giving money back guarantees because no one gives me any money, so I've got nothing to lose. Okay, next question. Yeah. Over here.
Ajahn, the one we saw on TV, Astro, the wonder boy from Nepal, went to deep meditation for days and ends and months,
yeah.
Disappeared into the jungle, he didn't eat anything, didn't drink anything, and so on.
Yeah.
Is that the sort of meditation we're talking about?
That tells me that that's the sort of thing which happens in jhana. Very, very deep meditation. So your body gets very still and peaceful. The amazing thing, now this is experiential, I don't know, it'd be great to do research on this, if you can ever get someone to get into jhana in a laboratory. Most people don't really, are not interested in doing such research. But you always have incredibly powerful health benefits. You know, sometimes, I'm getting old now, I'm not just over 60. Sometimes when I sit down, I get sore knees or sore back. It's just my body wearing out, just nature. But if you get a very deep meditation, you sit there for 4 or 5 hours. And when you come out, there's not an ache in the body. Everything is incredibly relaxed. And it doesn't really make sense. You know, if you think half an hour you're aching, an hour you'd be in agony, 4 or 5 hours they'd have to send you to hospital, give you pain injections. But no. In deep meditation, the body gets incredibly relaxed. And so much so that you come out afterwards, you feel like you can run a marathon. So it always has very, very, very positive health benefits. Why? I don't know.
Ajahn, some people fall sick and they fall into coma. What's the difference between coma and jhana?
What's the difference between coma and deep meditation? Okay, the coma. When a person, so there are two types of comas, as some of you might know. There's one which is it's not just that they don't react to stimuli, but they don't receive any stimuli as well. Because many people come out of coma and they tell you, while they were in coma, they could hear you, they could see you, they could feel you when they touched you, but they couldn't respond back. There's one of these ladies over in Singapore that she was in a coma, and she said, this is, I can understand this as a meditator, what brought her out of, she said she went to a very, very dark place, but she was basically unconscious. What brought her back was what she thought was the sound of a temple bell, and that brought her back into her body. The last of the five senses which turns off is the hearing. Even when you're on the edge of jhana, hearing can disturb you. The body is reasonably easy to let go of, but hearing, that's the tough one. So it's actually hearing brought her out of the coma. And then she was back in her body, in the hospital, but not able to speak or to move any part of her body. And soon, she had the experience of her sons visiting. Now, she was a Chinese girl. And the doctor telling the sons, there's no hope of any survival for your mother. I brought you here to ask permission to turn off the life support and let your mother die. And she was hearing this. And she was saying, I'm still here. Don't turn off the life support. I'm still alive. But she couldn't say anything. Now, being Chinese community, all the younger brothers say, no, elder brother, your decision. And he said, no, you can't let me do this. Please give me some help. He said, no, it's your decision. So the elder brother had the life of his mother in his own hands, and no one would support him. And she was using all of her concentration to try and will her son not to turn the machine off. And she had this amazing time of a few seconds where someone was deciding on her fate and she could not influence it. In the end, the son said, give her another day. Thank you, son. Thank you, son. She was thinking. And it just took another 24 hours and she started to be able to move one of her limbs. Enough to show the doctor there was something still left. And eventually she made 400% recovery, learning how to speak again, learning how to walk again. And she tells a story in public about what it's like to be in a coma. In a coma, there's no bliss. It's dull. It's almost like death. But remember, when someone is in a coma, please speak to them. Please touch them. Stimulate them. Tell them all the latest news. If it's your husband and he likes to support Manchester United in the soccer, tell him the latest results. He's dying to know. So those are the sorts of things which, you know, you want to be told what's happening. You can't ask the questions if you're in a coma. But that's actually what happens. In the deep jhanas, number one, you only go in for a short time, you come out again afterwards, perfectly healthy. In a coma, sometimes there's some brain damage. In meditation, no brain damage, no physical damage at all. And the experience is totally different. Does that answer the question? Sort of. Okay, yes?
Yeah, Ajahn. In your experience, for laymen like us, what is the effort we had to put in, or maybe the time we had to take, in order to achieve certain deep meditation, not even up to the first jhana, but a deep meditation?
Now that's a very nice question. What sort of effort do you have to put in? The effort is the problem. That's why any one of you can be able to do that, if you know how to stop making that effort. Effort is what creates the movement of the mind, stops you being still. And for meditation, you have to go against that stream of effort, of craving, to really know how to sit still, be totally content, to want nothing. No craving, no desires at all, not even for good things. Just to be here, be content with what's happening. Be still and not move your mind. Effort is what makes the mind move. The right effort of the Eightfold Path is the effort to stop, the effort to restrain, the effort to let go. The effort which does not cause more movement, but which stops movement. That's why it's very difficult. This goes against everything you've ever been taught in life. Each one of you have been very successful in your life. You studied hard at school. You've worked hard in your life. You've achieved a lot. Well done. But if you really want to go the whole hog, then that means, you know, go all the way to the end in meditation. You have to learn how to sit down and be totally still, not to move at all. Effort makes the mind move. Now that is why that everybody could do that, in theory. And you don't need to be a superpower athlete. It's fascinating because I teach jhanas and teach jhanas for a long time. I've become sometimes the what they call the go-to person for people who have weird meditation experiences. They come and ask me. And some years ago, during a retreat I was giving in Penang, they asked me, can you please do some counseling for this lady in Penang? And she'd been going to many counselors and psychiatrists and no one could fix her problem. But you might be able to. So I didn't know what her problem was. She came into the room and she described what had happened to her. And it was wonderful because what she described, she had got into a jhana. She didn't know why or what it was, and she thought she'd gone crazy. And when she told me, it was very, very clear to me, she said, you have just achieved a first jhana. And I also said, and these are the other things you would have experienced, which you haven't told me yet. Yeah, that was it. And she was so excited and so happy. She hadn't gone crazy at all. She'd had a very deep spiritual experience which she could not understand, and that was causing her the psychological problem. But once she had an expert tell her exactly what it was, and she knew that I knew, that means all the problems had disappeared. She was one case amongst many. Ordinary people who may not even know what they're doing, who sit down and are so content and so still, they really let go. And they have these amazing experiences. It is not that uncommon. I've come across the strangest of people who for one reason or another, they just let go, they give up, and they have these amazing experiences. That's why it is possible for anybody. It doesn't take willpower. It takes wisdom power. If it was willpower, you have to be some really tough guy or tough girl. Sit for hours, endure pain. That's not the way of a Buddha. You have to use wisdom. Wisdom power. Never willpower. I always got an idea of like the Buddha. This really peaceful, compassionate person. He would not put people through painful experiences. You know, the Buddha actually did that for 6 years before he became enlightened. And the first thing he did, the first teaching he gave, was the middle path. Please don't do that. So don't put so much effort in, it hurts. Don't do that. That's not the path of Buddhism. Use wisdom power, never willpower. Okay, very good.
You were talking about letting go and not thinking about anything in meditation. But when you're sitting down for more than half an hour, your body starts aching all over. How do you not try to think about it and not feel it?
Very good question. You're sitting meditating, the body starts to ache after half an hour. What should you do? Thing to do, move. It's all right to move the body. And you don't have to sit on the floor in full lotus to get enlightened. Sit on a chair. There are many, many of my disciples over in the West who meditate on chairs and get wonderful meditations. Because they're not used to sitting on the floor. Maybe your grandparents, your parents were used to sitting on the floor because we didn't have that many chairs in the old days. But today, when you got chairs in your house, you go to work, you sit in chairs on aircraft. And I was thinking of, on Real Buddha Air, I'm going to start an airline. We have no seats. You just sit cross-legged on the floor. That way you'd be able to get twice as many people in. You know, two stories in just an ordinary sort of 717 or 777. Just sitting cross-legged. All these stupid chairs. You'd be able to get many more people in. So it could be real, you know, it's Air Asia, should be, you know, really Air Asia, sitting on chairs and having squat toilets and go for the works. Anyway, so yes, you know, if, what was I going to be saying there? So what was the question again? I just lost track.
How you sort of think about it when you feel the pain all the time.
That's right, yeah. Well, the thing is, the first few minutes you never feel pain. When you first sit down, it's nice and easy. So that if you can actually focus sort of on letting go pretty quickly and sooner let the body disappear, there's no problem at all. Do you watch soccer on TV? How long does a soccer match go on for? Well, you have to move because it hurts. Or a movie. Look, if you're really enjoying yourself, you don't feel the pain in the body. And I know some people that can watch a movie 2 hours and they don't move. Ask them to meditate after 2 minutes. Oh, it hurts. Oh, I've got to move. Oh, I've got to get up. So what's the difference? If it's a movie or you're watching the soccer, it's very interesting. You're enjoying it. And it's a joy overcomes the aches and the pains in the body. It's a very good point, which I haven't brought up yet. As you let go more and more, as you meditate deeper and deeper, happiness just comes up little by little. You start to enjoy meditating. And once you start to get the piti sukha, the joy of meditation coming up, then you don't feel pains in the body, you're just having a good time. I've heard that sometimes, like sports people, can break a leg while they're playing soccer. And they don't feel any pain at all. Because they're so focused on the match. Only afterwards, oh, it really hurts, and they found they've broken their leg. If you're focused on something you enjoy, you don't feel aches and pains in the body. So see if you can get some fun up with that. Yes. That's right, up back. Oh, go ahead, hang on 1 minute, we get a microphone coming.
You talk about going into meditation and the result would be the separation of the will from your mind, presumably. I'm just wondering, how does one go forward after achieving this bliss that you are describing? And my second question is, it sounds like when you get this bliss, it's you. It's just you and it will not affect anybody else. Then how does one get on with everyday life?
Okay.
You are separating yourself. It means then that there is no human relationship, no need for it, because you have the bliss all by yourself.
Okay. First question first. It's answered by another simile which I made. Using an old metaphor, life being like a journey. So your life is a journey, and I called it like a bus journey. So imagine you're sitting in a bus, and sometimes your driver goes to very beautiful scenery, beautiful waterfalls and forests and mountains and seascapes, and you ask your bus driver, please slow down, I want to enjoy the happy moments. And you find your bus driver actually speeds up. And then you get to some very unpleasant scenery. Toxic waste dumps. Sort of places where there's been like Fukushima reactor disaster areas. Unpleasant places to see. And you ask your bus driver, please speed up, get out of here. And you find your bus driver slows down, even stops. That's a simile of our life. The happy times don't last as long as they should. And the unpleasant times last longer, too long. And so you want to find out your bus driver, your will, and teach your will how to stop when it's happy and accelerate away when it's unhappy. But first of all, you have to find the bus driver's seat. The seat of your will. Who's in charge? Who asked that question? Who is this? The way you find that out is again through meditation. So eventually you find your bus driver's seat. And that's where you get a great shock. You find the bus driver's seat is empty. There's no one sitting there. So what do you do? This is a question you ask. Once you find out the bus driver's seat is empty, what do? You go back to your seat on your bus and you stop complaining. There's no one to complain to anymore. In other words, you have happy times? Fine. They last long, they don't last long? Fine. There's no one to complain to. Life gets a bit difficult, have a bit of suffering in life? Fine. When there's no one to complain to, that's called the end of desire and ill will. So that's the first thing, what happens? You stop complaining anymore. So how you relate to things, it's not a selfish thing, there's no self in there. So the result of that is not just me becoming blissed out. There's no me in here. There's no separation between us anymore. As long as there's a me, then there's a you. Where there's no me anymore and there's no you, all that's left is us. So we share the bliss. Obviously, there's nothing else to do. So the result is not you become selfish, detached or lonely. Once the Buddha became enlightened, he went out to teach. Helped so many people, a blessing to the world. So that's what happens. And it's not detaching the will from the mind. It's just understanding what this will is. I'm not saying there is no will. Of course there's a will. I'm saying it doesn't come from you. You are not in control. It appears that way. But it's not. Okay.
Morning, Ajahn. Yesterday I was having a discussion with my friend on wisdom. As I was sharing about how incidents where someone's trying to irritate the situation, and I understand what is wisdom. I try to control my anger and I just allow the guy to do whatever he needs to do. And this is a friend of mine, is a doctor. He said, oh, you are suppressing your anger. That's how a lot of people are suffering from depression. So I said, yeah, you're right, but how shall I from the Buddhist term, how shall I talk to him? Because to me, I find that I know, I understand what is wisdom, and I know how to control on the situation. But when he asked me, I don't think so. I can.
Well, no, you can say, well, should the U.S. Marines suppress their anger in Afghanistan and Iraq? I think many people say at least they should stop a lot of their aggression. So it's very good to suppress things which cause harm to our community. It does not cause depression. It causes peace. It causes harmony. Should we suppress the robbers, the rapists, and the violent people in Sabah? Should we suppress them? Of course we should. So there are many things in our mind that we should suppress. The psychology says yes, suppress them, but don't stop with suppression. Suppression just means putting a boundary around your activities of body, speech and mind so we don't hurt ourselves and hurt others. It does not lead to suppression. What would lead to depression? Depression comes from people who become control freaks big time. You control, control, control. And look what happens in our modern world. The reason why there's more depression today than ever was, ever, because we have to work so hard to get by. And you know what it's like. You work so hard and sometimes obstacles come up. And it means you have to work harder. You have to really get your energy together. Really put everything you've got into something. And you work harder. You get frustrated. You get angry. That uses up so much energy. Much more energy than people have been using before. And after a while you just burn out. And burning out, that's called depression. You've just got nothing left anymore. So usually what happens, control leads to frustration, leads to anger, leads to desperation, and then depression. Restraint is good, but don't stop with restraint. When you restrain, understand what anger is. So first of all, don't express anger. Number two, understand it. Number three, it disappears. So you're not restraining anger anymore, you've just got no anger left. You have to start with restraining, then understanding, and then it's gone. Does that make sense? But look, whoever said that is not a psychologist. You have to restrain. Is that okay? Yes, another question.
Ajahn.
Okay, yeah, the man over there afterwards, yes. Very good.
So on your talk today, would you help us to summarize what we need to know if we want to practice your advocacy of letting go meditation?
Easy. Thanks. You're holding the cup. Put it down. Let it go. Be content. Happy to be here. Make peace, not war, with your mind. Be compassionate to things, not angry at your mind. Let things be. Open the door of your heart to your mind, to your enemies. Even the enemies inside your mind. Let them be. And then you'll find all the enemies disappear and become friends. An enemy feeds on your anger. The more anger you give it, the more of a problem they become. Give them peace, kindness, compassion. And after a while, you wear them out. You starve them. And then they're never an enemy anymore. And that goes to things in the mind as well as in the world. How many times have we had wars? Trying to solve the problem through violence, through control. And how many times have people actually tried compassion? Wouldn't it have been a wonderful thing? And I said this at the time after 9/11. I was praying that this would happen, that George W. Bush would go on TV after 9/11 and say, I forgive everybody, whoever did this. There's been too many people died already. I don't want to kill any more people. Whoever, whatever organization was responsible for this tragedy, the United States will not retaliate. I forgive on behalf of the American people and everybody else who suffered under 9/11. That would have been fantastic. Imagine what they'd have done in the world. One day that would happen.
So basically any one of us can just go back tonight, just sit down, find a quiet place, and start practicing letting go. Any other instructions other than that?
Basic meditation is second factor of the Eightfold Path. Who knows what the second factor of the Eightfold Path is? Come on, all of you people who are Dhamma school. Right? Right thought, right intention, that's the two. And there are three types of right thought. Who knows the three types of right thought or right intention? First one is Nekama Sankapa. which is thoughts, intentions of letting go, renouncing. Second one is avayapada sankappa, thoughts, intentions of kindness. And the third one is ahimsaka sankappa, thoughts, intentions of gentleness. That's an important part of the Eightfold Path. You're doing these things to let go, not to gain something, with kindness, with gentleness. That applies to meditation especially. So when you meditate, let go, be kind, be gentle. That's all you need to do. Whatever you're experiencing in meditation is not important. How you are experiencing it is very, very important. So remember, just sit down, just let go. Sometimes I say, make peace, be kind, be gentle with whatever you're experiencing. That's how you get deep meditation. There was a gentleman in the back there, so maybe the last question then. I've got plenty of time, yeah. Yeah. There we go.
Obviously, meditation is good. But can meditation be substituted for normal sleep? Because sometimes when you have a deep sleep, or maybe even deep meditation for half an hour, it feels as if you have slept for more than 6 hours. You feel very fresh. So from your experience, can you enlighten us, what's the difference between deep sleep or deep meditation? And if I were to tell my wife, when she say go to sleep now, I say, no, I'm meditating for another half an hour, and I can make it up easily 5 or 6 hours. Thanks.
That's very true. That meditation, your brain is becoming very still, very peaceful, which means that the main purpose of sleep, to regenerate the brain, is being achieved through meditation. So it's well known that when you meditate a lot, your requirement to sleep goes down, down, down. And it always happens. I just was finishing a meditation retreat about 8 days ago, and there's a couple of people, they came up to me and said, I couldn't sleep last night. I said, of course not. You've got deep meditation. You don't need to sleep. You know, your brain was just so rested all day, it was hardly working. If you don't drive your car, you don't need to fill up at the petrol station. So it's obvious, you know, you're very peaceful and still, so you don't need to actually have sleep. Always trust your body. If it needs to sleep, it will sleep. If it doesn't need to, you know, you can lay down, no way will you go to sleep. So just meditate. So if your wife doesn't believe you, I'll sign a form. I hereby give you permission to not to sleep because you're meditating. I'll give you license. Yes?
Can we take one more question? It's again a question about the effects of meditation, but not just for this life. Can you clean up bad karma from other lives through meditation in this life?
Okay.
This one question, the second one.
Yeah.
You mentioned that when we have reached the deep meditation, there is no self anymore. There's no I, but there are we. So my question is, can I meditate for my parents who passed away? Can I give them this good feeling as a gift? Is it possible?
Okay. The first question about meditating away the bad karma from previous lives. It's once one understands the nature of the will, then you can ask yourself, who is responsible for your past karma? If there's no person inside, who's there to blame? Now I'm saying this not just to be a way to get out of the bad karma. You can't think this. Once you know what we mean by no self, anatta, you've experienced it, you realize there's no one in there, you are what's called a stream winner, a sotapanna. And you may know that stream winners, sotapannas, are no longer subject to rebirth in the lower realms. You know why? Because once you realize what this self is, you know, who is responsible for all the good karma and the bad karma you've done? And basically, it's nothing there. Once you realize that, forgiveness becomes 100% possible. You can let go of your past karma. You don't need to punish yourself anymore. As a Westerner, I sometimes ask questions which maybe Asians wouldn't ask. Why do people go to hell in Buddhism? Is there a being who sends you to hell? No one would send anyone to hell. It's supposed to be Yama Deva. A Deva, a very high Deva. How can a person who's got such goodness and compassion send anyone to prison? I couldn't do that. If I was a judge, I'd forgive everybody. Oh, never mind, I'll forgive you. I'll let it go. Come on, off you go. Don't do it again. I can never torture anybody. So I asked myself, who sends you to hell? And the answer was very clear. You do. You send yourself to hell. If you think you deserve it. If you can't forgive yourself. If you can't let the past go. You know, many people send themselves to hell even in this life. They've done an act which they're ashamed of. They said something they wish they'd never said. And they keep punishing themselves again and again and again. As a Buddhist, after a while, you learn how to let go, to have so much compassion you can forgive yourself anything, almost anything. And it's a wonderful feeling. I don't need to punish myself anymore. All those terrible, terrible, terrible jokes I've said in public over the years, I don't need to feel bad about them anymore. And that's a wonderful thing to realize. That's part of understanding non-self. Which means, through meditation, you find the wisdom to let go of the past. That's how you overcome your bad karma. It's just this realization, I can let it all go. That's a wonderful realization. You feel so absolutely free. No more any bad rebirths. And for your parents, sometimes when my mother, she's what I call half dead. She has dementia. I went to visit her last month, but she can't remember me. She doesn't know who I am. And my father died a long time ago. But I know it's supposed to be a Buddhist thing, but I think it's a common human trait. We have gratitude and love for our parents. So I often think of my father. And the way I can repay my debt to my father and my mother is by being a good person, someone they will be proud of, someone, if they could see me today, will be so happy. That's my son giving a talk in Sabah today. Oh, I'm so proud of him. Do things which your mother and father will be so proud of. And then, if they did look upon you, they'll give them so much happiness. That is the way that our good karma is transferred. And sometimes beings reborn in other realms, they do take a peek and see what we're doing. And when they see you being a really good daughter, they think, wow, she's such a good girl. And it makes your mum and dad just weep with joy. And that's where their good karma gets transferred. We haven't asked a question yet. I've got a few more minutes. Is that okay? Carry on for a bit. There's a question which somebody keeps asking. Is all this jhana, 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 that's samatha practice. What about vipassana? Once upon a time, there was this husband and wife. This was over in the West. They were both good meditators. Now the husband, his name was Sam. Sam Atta. And his wife was called Vi. Vipassana. So Sam and Vi, after lunch, they decided to go for a walk up Meditation Mountain. They decided to take their dog with them for a walk. The dog was called Metta. So Sam Atta, Vipassana, and Metta the dog went for a walk up Meditation Mountain. Now Sam he went for the walk up Meditation Mountain because it was so peaceful, so still up Meditation Mountain. And he loved stillness. So he went up there for calm. His wife, Fai, she just enjoyed the view. Because on top of the mountain, you could see forever. So she took her camera with her to take lots of insights. And the dog met her. The little dog met her. She just went up there for fun. This is dogs would do. They don't think too much. So Sam, Fai, and Meta the dog walked up Meditation Mountain. When they got even halfway, oh, it's so peaceful up there. Just so serene. Sam was so happy, even halfway up Meditation Mountain. As for Vi, even halfway up, you could see long distances. So she took many photographs. And Meta the dog, even halfway up, she was so happy she started wagging her tail. But when they got to the top of Meditation Mountain, wow, that was so still. Sam was just so happy. Experienced the bliss better than sex on top of Meditation Mountain. So still. But you know, Sam had a pair of eyes too. So he could also enjoy the great view. He could see everywhere. Vi, oh, she could have such wonderful views. It's such a clear day. She was taking so many insight shots on her camera. But you know, Vi, she could also experience the peace and stillness up there. It was so quiet. And Meta the dog, even dogs have eyes. She could see the insights. And even the dog could experience the great stillness up there. But she had so much Meta, she was wagging her tail like it's going to fall off and running around in circles like dogs do when they're very happy. And the reason is, because on top of Meditation Mountain, yes, it's calm. Yes, it's insights. Yes, it's metta. Because they all coexist on the top of Meditation Mountain. You may think you're meditating for peace, for calm. But you'll also find deep insights and lots of metta on top of Meditation Mountain. You may think you're just doing insight meditation, but when you get the deep insights, you'll also experience the calm as well, just like Vi did, and also have lots and lots of metta. And if you're just doing it because you're following the path of compassion, on the top of Meditation Mountain, if you develop your metta, you'll also find, oh, deep peace and wonderful insights. Because Meditation Mountain, metta, insight, jhanas, all coexist. So there's no difference. It's not samatha meditation, it's not vipassana meditation, it's not metta meditation, it's just meditation, that's all. They all come together. Okay, very good.
Honor. In the meditation which you have just told us, we have to let go. But there are many things in our for practical living. We have to focus and be focused and concentrate very hard, no, to achieve perfection. Now, does it mean we have to break our lives into two distinct portions, or how do we move seamlessly from one to the other?
Once, another story. Once there was a man being chased by a tiger. Now there's two things to know about tigers. Number one, they eat you. You are dinner. Are there any tigers in Sabah? Ah. But anyway, the tigers can eat you. And number two, a tiger can run much faster than Usain Bolt. So you've got no chance at all. So this man was being chased by a tiger, and a tiger was catching up on him. And the last moment he saw a well in the jungle. And so he had no other choice. He jumped into the well. And as soon as he jumped in, he realized, big mistake. Because that well was dry. And in the bottom of the well was a big black snake. It was not his lucky day. Instinctively, he reached out and he grabbed a tree root which was coming out the side of the well. It stopped his fall. And then he looked down and the snake had been disturbed, had raised its head, opened its head, trying to bite his feet. But his feet were just too high. The snake couldn't quite reach. And he looked up, and the tiger hadn't given up on his lunch yet. The tiger was leaning over, trying to paw him from above. But his hands were just too far away. The tiger couldn't reach his hands. So he was safe for the time being. And then he noticed two mice come out from a hole in the well and start chewing on the root, making it thinner and thinner and thinner. He wouldn't be able to last that much longer. One was a black mouse, the other one was a white mouse. And because the tiger was trying to paw him, the back of the tiger was rubbing against the tree, making the tree shake. On a branch of that tree, just above the opening of the well, was a bee's nest. Don't worry about the bees were fine, but the honey started to drip out. And the man put out his tongue and enjoyed the honey. Mmm, it was so delicious. And that's the end of the story. Now, I love that story. It answers the question because, look, when there's nothing to do, enjoy the honey. Yeah, okay, you've got a snake below you trying to bite you, a tiger above you trying to paw you, but it doesn't mean you can't enjoy the honey of life. So when there's nothing to do, let go. Just like that man. Now that's a very old Buddhist story. But I gave it my ending, because I'm always a very positive thinker. Because I said, what happened next? After he'd enjoyed the honey. The tigers, I know the nature of tigers, they won't give up on their lunch. He leant over a little bit too far, trying to reach that man, and fell into the well. He missed the man, but fell on top of the snake, crushed the snake to death, and broke his own neck. So that way the tiger died, the snake died, and so the man at his leisure could climb out the well. No trouble at all. That's possible, that could happen. So, when you're dying of cancer, and when your accountant says you're bankrupt and you owe lots of money, and the triads are after you to try and get your money back, when life is very difficult, you've got a snake underneath you, and you've got a tiger above you, or the other way around, don't forget to enjoy the honey. Mmm, that's so delicious. Because you don't know what's going to happen next. And that's why we can learn how to let go, be peaceful, enjoy the honey of life. And no, things always change. It's the other story that opened the door of your heart. That was an old Buddhist story. This is a modern story. I was a school teacher for 1 year. And one of my fellow school teachers told me this story. He was in the British Army in the Second World War. And he was actually fighting the Japanese in Burma. He said one day he was with a small group of British soldiers, maybe half a dozen or so, and they were on patrol in the jungle. And they had a scout. The scout came back and told everybody they just stumbled into the middle of a whole regiment of Japanese troops. They were totally surrounded, vastly outnumbered. And he thought he was about to die. Now, this was war. And Japanese, many times outnumbered, totally surrounded. But if any of you have known anybody in the military, one thing they always say is no one can ever predict who the hero will be. Sometimes people, they're small people, they've never done much, but they're the ones who step up to the plate, as they say, and become the hero. And other, the tough guys, become the cowards. No one ever knows until you're faced with imminent death. But this fellow, he decided to be the hero. He asked his captain, "I'll try and fight my way out. Who knows? We might get through. Chances are we'll all get killed, but at least we can take many of the enemy with us. Let's fight." And the captain said, "No. We're not fighting," said the captain. "Instead, I give you orders to all sit down and make a cup of tea." It was the British Army, after all. And we like our tea. I had a nice cup of tea. I had lots of tea here. Very nice tea. So this fellow thought, this is a crazy. How can you think, even in the British Army, of having a cup of tea when you're at war, surrounded by the enemy, vastly outnumbered, about to die? And he thought, it's the craziest thing he's ever done in his life. He had no choice. It was an order in the army. So he made a cup of tea, thinking this would be his last cup of tea in his life. Before they finished drinking the tea, the scout came back, said something to the captain, and the captain whispered to the soldiers, "Put all your stuff away quickly. The enemy is moved. There's a way out." And they crawled through that gap in the surrounding forces, and they all escaped with no injury. And he said, what a wise captain that was. They were surrounded, about to die. He wanted to fight his way out. His captain said, "No, sit down, let go, relax." And because he could do that, when the situation changed, then he could act. And they all escaped. Now that is one of our problems in life. When we are surrounded by misfortune, when we can't see any way out, most of us don't know how to sit down and have a cup of tea. We tend to fight, make matters worse for ourselves and others. When you know how to meditate, you know how to let go. Between a snake and a tiger, you can just relax. When you're at war, surrounded by the enemy, just relax. If you don't like a cup of tea, well, what's the favorite? Have a bit of durian. Yeah, have a durian. Enjoy yourself. You're about to die, so go out with this one. But what happens? Because you're relaxing, the future always changes. No one can predict what's going to happen in the next 5 minutes. The economy always changes. Successful business people always notice that, yeah, it may look bleak today, but opportunities are always opening up. Opportunities to escape. And if you haven't wasted all of your energies fighting a battle you can't win, you sit down and rest. When there is an opportunity, you can take it. And that's where people become successful, in business and in life. When there's something to do, give it everything you've got. When there's nothing to do, do nothing. Makes a lot of sense to me. Any other questions before we finish off? And you guys have got to go to work, so you better do something. Okay, bye-bye.
If there is no more question, then please, we thank Ajahn with Sadhu 3 times. Sadhu, Sadhu.
That's very depressing. Now, for those of you who see me in Singapore, in Malaysia, West Malaysia, remember what I said, if you're going to do something, give it everything you've got. So now we're going to do the 3 big sadhus. Please follow me. Sadhu.
Sadhu. Sadhu.
Now, again, on your own.
Sadhu.
Sadhu.
Very good, that's better. But by the end of my tour, I'm sure we can really get it up there. You see, it makes you happy. You just sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Really depressing. No one wants to come to Buddhist temple, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So I remember, sadhu. That's called giving everything you've got, which makes you very happy and makes coming to the Buddhist temple fun instead of boring. So all your kids come as well. Very good.
Thank you.
Very good. So see you guys.